Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dan Ashley, news anchor for ABC 7 Television in San Francisco and a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Directors and your moderator for today's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker today, Rob Reiner.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
From his starring role as Meathead on the popular 1970s sitcom.
By the way, you're the first person to call me that today.
It's still early.
Yeah,
it's true. On that wonderful program, All in the Family, to his blockbuster films, and he has so many. Boy, when you look at his list of films, it's really remarkable. The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, A Few Good Men, just to name a handful, there are many more. Reiner has been entertaining audiences for decades with his singular humor and artistic vision. As a director, he's worked with A-list actors, Jack Nicholson, Tom Cruise, Kathy Bates, as well as celebrated writers Nora Ephron and Aaron Sorkin. Son of comedic genius Carl Reiner, he grew up in a political family where civil rights were a frequent topic around the kitchen table. As such, he has become not only a Hollywood legend, but a political activist as well. After November 4th, 2008, when California passed a constitutional amendment banning marriage for gay and lesbian couples, Rob Reiner co-founded the American Foundation for Equal Rights as a way to challenge Proposition 8 in the courts. In light of the Supreme Court's recent decision to hear challenges to both Prop 8 and DOMA this year, we are delighted to have Mr. Reiner here with us today to discuss his views on the future of marriage equality and his incredible contributions to the entertainment industry. Please, once again, a warm welcome to Rob Reiner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks, Dan. Thank you. Thank you.
First of all, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about the entertainment industry and
sure.
your background, and then we'll
sure.
move into your social activism.
Sure.
How's your dad, by the way, Carl?
My dad, thanks for asking. My dad is doing great. He's 90 years old. He's going to be 91 in a month and a half. And he's still sharp as a tack. He walks around the block every day. I can't keep up with him. I mean, it's incredible.
Does he work still?
He writes. He just wrote an autobiography called I Remember Me. And and it's just coming out now. And, you know, he writes every day. And he and Mel Brooks, every single night, They get together. Mel comes over to the house every night. They sit and they have dinner and they watch a movie. And their thing is, they say, any movie that has Secure the Perimeter in it, they'll watch. So yeah, but they have fun with each other and they have each other, and it's great. Mel is I think 86 or 87.
And he's doing great.
And he's doing great too.
How fortunate to have that lifelong friendship with someone.
Oh, it's
like
incredible. I mean, they've known each other, you know, 60 years, since the Show of Shows. And I met him when I was 4 years old. I met Mel Brooks when I was 4 years old. We had a little place in Fire Island, which is a little island off the coast of Long Island. And my dad told me, and my sister, who was two at the time, there was going to be a man who was going to, we were going to go to bed, and there was going to be a man who was going to be staying over. So if we woke up in the morning and we found a man, a strange man, just know that this a friend of ours, this man is going to be sleeping. And so at 5 o'clock in the morning, this is the introduction that Mel Brooks has to us. There's two kids standing, and he's in this little like window seat where he's sleeping, I'm turning to my sister. And I go, is that the man? She says, is that the man? Is that the man? I said, yeah, that's the man. That's the man. That man is the man. And so she goes and she takes his eyes like this. I said, that's the man? Yeah, I said, that's the man. So that's all. So the Mel Brooks, he was the man, and he's still the man. Yeah. Yeah.
what a wonderful upbringing to be around these characters.
Yeah, yeah.
Did it dawn on you at the time that it was unusual?
Yeah. No, it didn't, actually, because my house, I mean, there was Mel Brooks, the Norman Lear, Sid Caesar. I mean, some of the funniest people, you know, in the world were coming through my house. But, you know, when as a kid growing up, you don't think of yourself as different. You know, you're just in your house as a kid. And it wasn't until I went to my friend Stephen Rabin's house where I realized it's not so funny over there. Not nearly as funny as at my house.
Did you know early on, because of that environment, that you wanted to be in the entertainment
industry? Well, I didn't know I wanted to be in the entertainment business, but I my dad tells this story, and I don't remember it, but I he tells it. I was 8 years old, and I went up to him and I said, "Dad, I want to change my name." And he went, oh, he felt so bad because he thought, oh my God, this poor kid, you know, he has to live up to, you know, Carl Reiner and the fame and all the success and, you know, this poor kid. And he says to me, what do you want to change your name to? And I said, Carl. And so I obviously wanted to be like him. I didn't think about show business, but I wanted to be like him. Yeah.
And he was supportive as you got into show business?
Oh, yeah. No, he always was. He was very proud of me when I, you know, did All in the Family and all of that. I remember when I did I was 19 years old, and I started when I was about 17 in summer theater, and I had an improvisational theater group when I was 19. And when I was 19, I directed a production of No Exit, Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit. Richard Dreyfuss was in it and a few other people that I knew. And my father came to the show, and he looked at me. It was the first time that I knew he looked at me in the eye and he said, "That was good. No BS." And really? He said, like, to me. And I knew at that point, you know, he was saying you were going to be okay. And then I went to visit him at his house, and he said, "I'm not worried about you. Whatever you decide to do, you're going to be okay."
When he said to you that was good, that must have been a very proud moment.
Oh, my
you.
God. It was incredibly. I felt so good about that because I did look up to him. He was like a god to me, you know. I mean, he had done the Dick Van Dyke Show, and, you know, he's on Show of Shows. And I was like, you know, he was my idol. So when he said that to me, it meant a lot. When I was this is a great story. When I was a little boy, and this is true, my father was on television before we owned a television. It's true.
Really?
He was on, yeah, and we got a television when I was about 4 or 5 years old so we could watch him, you know. He was doing Show of Shows. We had a little tiny television, black and white, that was a screen that big. And my father used to say to me, at the end of the show, they'd have the good night. So the whole cast would come out to say their final bows and everything. And my father said, you know, I can't wave at you. You know, I'm not allowed to wave at you because they don't like that. But when they come out at the end, I'm going to go like this with my tie. Ah. And that's me telling you that I love you and it's time for you to go to sleep. So every Saturday night, he would go like this with a tie. And that was a thing. So I learned to, you know, that was my relationship. My dad, and he was a great guy around the house. He was a regular dad. And oddly enough, we had a real kind of normal life in a way, because the Show of Shows was on 13 weeks, it was on 39 weeks a year, live, an hour and a half live, 39 weeks.
Wow.
And then they were off 13 weeks. So that 13 weeks, which was during the summer, we spent the summers together. And so, you know, it was probably, I had more time with them than a lot of parents.
Most
did.
People don't get
13 weeks in a row, yeah, to be with your dad.
Very demanding when he was working, but
well,
he
when
had
he
that
was working,
time.
Yeah. I remember one time going down to the Show of Shows, and there was the writer's room. And, you know, we're talking about Neil Simon and Woody Allen and, you know, Mel Brooks, Larry Gelbart, some of the most brilliant writers, Sid Caesar, Mel Brooks, and my dad and everybody. And I remember as like 5 or 6 years old, sitting up waiting for him to come out of the writer's room. And all I could remember was screaming, crazy, screaming at each other, you know, because they were fighting for their jokes or whatever. And I said, "That's comedy? They're making comedy in it? Sounds like they're killing each other in there." But some of the funniest stuff in the world came out. And if you think about it, the second half of the 20th century, really, you can trace back to anything you ever laughed at really came out of that room, because it's all of Woody Allen's work, all of Neil Simon's work, Joe Stein, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof and Enter Laughing, Larry Gelbart, who wrote MASH and Tootsie and Aaron Rubin, who created the Andy Griffith Show and Gomer Pyle, my dad and Mel Brooks, you know. So everything, you know, basically the second half of the 20th century comedy was all coming out. And Mike Stewart, who wrote Hello, Dolly. I mean, they were incredible writers.
When you think about it, when you put it like that, it's really actually remarkable. It was a magic time with a very unique group of people creating this media.
Yes, and they called it the golden age of television, because it was. Television was a brand new medium. And you had to have some money to own a television set, quite frankly. So the fare was more highbrow. It was an extension of theater. It was an extension of reviews and satire and a very upscale type of a theater that was put on television. You had Lux Video Theater, the Playhouse 90. And then television became a mass media, and you saw all kinds of dumbing down of things. I contest that right now we're in our second golden age of television because of, the cable TV, and you're looking at, you know, Mad Men and Breaking Bad and Homeland and brilliant shows that are done with great writing, great acting, and it's almost like the second golden age of television right now.
I tell people a lot who ask me about television that, yes, there is a lot of junk on television now, but there's also more quality on television than there's probably ever been.
Yes, I think there is. And I think that if you look at, you know, AMC and HBO and Netflix, I mean, all of these Apple TV, I mean, all these different ways of accessing these, you know, niche type shows, they are really smart shows.
Right.
I mean, really, really smart. Nothing that would have been put on the networks. I mean, we were lucky in that we got All in the Family on, which was, you know, a fairly elevated type of show at the time that it was on, because when we came on the air, you had the Beverly Hillbillies, Gomer Pyle, you know, Mayberry Arfty, all of the rural type shows, and all of a sudden we had this urban comedy that dealt with issues that came on. So that was a rare thing at that time. But now you see all kinds of really good television on.
Yeah, no question. Let's talk about All in the Family for a moment before we move on. Do you find people then or even now sometimes... It was progressive for the time, obviously. Did people understand that it wasn't celebrating bigotry? It was ridiculing.
Oh, no.
Did people get that?
We basically shone a light on, the ignorance of a bigot, and that's what we did. But it was, you know, we didn't just... go outside the box, or you know, go to the the edge of the envelope. We destroyed the envelope. We broke the box. Everything. I mean, CBS had a disclaimer on before we came on, which essentially said, "We don't have anything to do with this show. You want to watch it? It's up to you, because we don't know what the heck this is." And despite that, we were able to succeed. And I think in large part because, aside from the fact that it was funny and we dealt with issues, there were real people that people could identify. They saw themselves. They either saw themselves in Archie or they saw themselves in Mike. We presented two points of view. Norman Lear talked about how his favorite play was Major Barber by George Bernard Shaw. George Bernard Shaw was a liberal, but if you didn't know he was a liberal and you went to see that play, both the hawk point of view and the dove point of view were presented with equal eloquence, with equal intelligence, and then was let up to the audience to make their minds up as to what they believed. That was Norman's feeling. Let's just throw this out there and let's get a dialogue started. And at the time, there was no VCRs, there was no DVR, no TiVo, nothing. So it really did promote a dialogue. If you wanted to watch the show, you had to watch it when it was on.
Right.
That meant that you were having a shared experience with everybody else who was watching it at that time. And I've made this point before. We, at the time, were a country of about 200 million people. And of the 200 million people, anywhere between 30 and 45 million people at one time were watching that show. Now we're in a country of over 300 million. And if you have a show that does 10, 15 million viewers, that's a major hit right now. So, and you're not watching it at the same time as everybody else because you've got it on your DVR or your TiVo and you're, you know, so you're not, but Saturday night, if you watched the show, that meant Monday, people were talking about whatever it is we talked about. And that shared experience, I think, was a very good thing for our country.
It's hard to cut through the noise now as a programmer.
It really is. Right. It really, really is. I mean, there's so much out there. And I've often said that I feel with the internet, with 24-hour day cable news service, we have, I think, the potential of being less informed than being more informed. Because when TV news became a profit center, it changed everything. I mean, there was a big deal when Walter Cronkite was on CBS, and the broadcast went from 15 minutes to a half hour. That was a big deal. It was like, oh my God, a half an hour? That meant that CBS was throwing away a half hour of revenue. Because news outlets were a lost leader. You didn't make money on news. So, and all they did was report the news. There was no commentary. There was no, you know, you had that for your newspapers. You can get your op-eds from newspaper. Then 60 Minutes came along, which is a brilliant show. It's a great show, but they started making money. And all of a sudden, it was in like late 60s, early 70s, they realized, uh-oh, we can make money off the news. And then you had big corporations taking over the TV outlets and news outlets, and it all became about, you know, profit center and bottom line. And it, I think, has made us less informed. I really believe that. You know, it's hard to find, you know, real accurate reporting. I mean, you know, how many people read the New York Times? And a lot of people argue that that isn't, you know, certainly the people at Fox would argue that's not, they're biased, you know, or something like that. But, you know, that's another
discussion.
This sounds
discussion. Like part of my talk that
that's
I give about television
discussion,
news.
Yeah.
Let's move now to, from All in the Family. Well, let me, I want to back up and ask you one question. I referred to your character, Michael Stivic, as Meathead, which
yes.
is a, does that bother you when people refer to, is that something
no.
you want to, are you
no,
proud
it,
of it still?
No, it doesn't bother me. Yeah. I always found it odd that, I mean, I made the joke, you know, you're the first, you know, that's the first person to call me Meathead today. I get called that virtually every day, even now, and I don't even look like anything that I look like on television. My kids watch the show and they said, Dad, it sounds like you, but it doesn't look like you, you know? But I get called that all the time, and I used to find it strike me funny that that the guy who was espousing my point of view, who was clearly, whether or not you agreed with him or not on his liberal point of view, he was probably more schooled and intelligent than Archie, was being called the Meathead.
That's the irony.
But look at the source of where that came from.
Right.
But then that was just accepted. I'm a Meathead, you know, because that ignorant person called me that, I become that. And that was Norman Lear's father used to call him that. That's where he got that. He said,
it's a term
he
of
said, you're a Meathead, you're dead from the neck up, you know. That's a nice father for you.
But when people call you that now, it's a term of endearment. That's
oh, yeah.
Not,
no, no, it's just they recognize right, it, and, right, it's, right. and it's, yeah, it's fine.
Iconic in a way.
Yeah,
right.
That's fine. That's fine.
So you acted in the early days. You still act some to this
Yeah,
to this
I
day.
Just acted in a movie. I did a little part in a Martin Scorsese movie. It's called The Wolf of Wall Street. Leonardo DiCaprio plays a real guy named Jordan Belfort, who was a stock manipulator, went to jail in the late 80s, early 90s. And I make the joke, I said, well, and I play his father, you know, and I said, well, what's more unbelievable, that Leonardo DiCaprio is a Jew or that I'm his father? So you determine that one.
Very good.
Yeah.
Excellent. Is that out yet? Not out yet.
No, we just finished shooting. It'll be out probably the end of the year.
Is it hard? Do you like acting still as now that you're really a director full time?
I love to act. It's fun, yeah. You know, and I don't have responsibility. It's not as hard. I mean, directing is a lot of responsibility. I actually enjoy directing more, but acting is like fun. It's like a lark. I remember years ago, Ron Howard was making a movie called EdTV, and he calls me up and he says, do you want to act? There's a part in here if you want to act in it. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And he says, well, let me send you the script and see if you want to do it. I said, you don't have to send me a script. I said, if it stinks, it's not my fault. You know? So I look at it that way. You know, it's like, okay, I'm fine. I'll do whatever they want me to do.
It's not my responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. I did a Woody Allen film years ago called Bullets Over Broadway. And I don't say anything, you know. I don't say anything to the director. I mean, because I know as a director, I don't want actors giving me me grief, you know. I got too many problems. Just do your job, you know. Just go in and do your job. I show up there and I look around. It's an outdoor scene, you know, with John Cusack and Alan Arkin. And it's at night and outdoor. And I look at it and I said, you know, gee, if I don't... I don't know if there must be some kind of film stock. I'm not aware of it because it's too dark. It'll never show up. But I'm not going to say anything because it's Woody Allen. It's Carlo De Palma. Great guy. I don't want to say anything. We do the scene. They call me the next day at the hotel room. We watch the dailies, the thing. It's a radio show. It's totally black. Not only that, so I should have probably spoke up then, but I didn't.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Hollywood legend and activist Rob Reiner about films, politics, and the future of marriage equality. I'm Dan Ashley, anchor of ABC 7 News, your moderator today. How do you pick a project when you choose a film to direct? You've had so many remarkable successes in several different genres in film.
Well, I try to find... Spinal Tap and Princess Bride were satires, and I kind of like satire, and that was a different kind of thing. Princess Bride was my favorite book as a kid growing up. But normally what I'll do is I'll look, how do I get into this? Where is my way into this story? Okay. Is there a character that I can identify with that I can tell the story through? Like in Stand By Me, or even in A Few Good Men. I'll look, and of course When Harry Met Sally was born out of my inability to make a go of it with women during the time when I was going through a divorce. I mean, I'd been divorced. I'd been single for 10 years. Oh, yeah, it was totally autobiographical. I was making a mess of it. And I said, well, how the heck do you get with a woman? And, you know, if you have sex, does it ruin the friendship? And I couldn't figure anything. I said, this will be a good movie. Let's make a movie. So that's gave birth. So I usually try to find my way into it in terms of one of the characters.
Is it a great joy to direct, or is it stressful, or both?
It's both. It's both. I mean, you know, I love doing it because what I've always said is a director, I mean, my thing, is not great at anything. But you got to be good at a lot of little things. The writers are better writers. The actors can act better. The cameraman can shoot better. The music guy can make music better. The designer can design better. But if you have a little knowledge in a lot of areas, you can do it, you know. And I have one of those kind of brains that I have a little musical ability. I have a little artistic thing. I can act a little. I can write a little. And it all kind of comes together. So it is the most satisfying because I get to use all of the parts of me. And I don't have to be good at anything. So that's good.
You know, one of the things I often do when I'm coming here or any sort of interview I do is I will ask my colleagues, not necessarily my reporting colleagues, but just people I work with in the building, hey, I'm going to see Rob Reiner tomorrow. Anything you'd like to ask? And I asked our floor director, who's been there for a number of years, and he's worked a lot in the movies. And he said, yeah, ask him this. He's never worked on a picture you've done. But he said he has a reputation of being tough on the crew. Ask him if he is tough on the ground. Are you a demanding boss?
Boy, that is a weird one because I'm like the easiest guy. The crew's like they want to take me home because I don't work more than 9 or 10 hours any day. Okay. They say, wow, we don't get overtime, but I get to be with my family, so they always like it. It's weird to hear. I've never heard that one.
Okay, well, that's good.
I've been tough on some people, but not the crew. Never the crew.
Here's a question from the audience, Rob. Interesting. If you could have played the leading role in any of your movies that you directed, which would it have been and why?
Well, I think it probably would have been When Harry Met Sally because it was the closest to me. My mother is in the deli there, you know, when she the woman who says, I'll have what she's having, that's my mother there. So,
oh, boy.
And that, there's a great story to there because we had this scene and Meg Ryan was a little bit nervous about doing it because she had to fake an orgasm in front of all the crew there and all the extras and everybody. And so she did it the first couple of times and it wasn't so good and she was kind of weak and kind of half-hearted. And we did it again. She couldn't do it. I said, Meg, let me just show you what I want. I sat down. I sat down at the table opposite Billy and I'm going, yes, 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 I'm doing it. I'm acting out the whole thing. And Billy said it was like, you know, being on a date with Sebastian Cabot or somebody. But I realized that I'm having an orgasm in front of my mother, you know? And I thought, oh my God, you know. It was, but it worked out fine. But I probably would have been that way.
Are you sort of still recovering from that experience?
I am. A few extra years of therapy have made it work out okay.
Let's transition a little bit here, Rob, and I want to go back to All in the Family to make this transition. That film, that program, as we talked about, was very progressive, very political. Were you a political guy before that show? I know you grew up in a political household. Or did that help inform your activism later in life?
Well, it's interesting. I've been asked that question, and what people don't understand is, yes, I grew up in a political household. Both my mother and father were active. My father marched in the moratorium here in San Francisco during the Vietnam War. My mother was part of a group called Another Mother for Peace. She helped design the poster, War is Unhealthy for Children and Other Living Things. So those issues were always talked about in my house. So that was something I grew up in. Now, doing All in the Family, what got me interested in the active part of it, I was always interested in politics and what was going on, but what got me interested to be active was essentially watching Norman Lear and how he functioned. It was separate and apart from All in the Family. He took his fame, celebrity, success, whatever, what have you, and started an organization called People for the American Way, which was a way of pushing back against the religious right, because they, at the time, the religious right was trying to own patriotism, as if you were not part of the religious right, you were not a patriot. Or if you were a liberal, you weren't a patriot. And he felt, no, I fought in the Second World War. I'm a patriot. I should have that. I should have that represented for me. And so he started People for the American Way. I saw that there is a way in which you can use your celebrity, your fame, your success, whatever, and put it to some good. So that's really the experience. It was my parents, you know, introducing me to the area and then seeing how you could actively do something with your success. So those are the things that pushed me forward.
Is your father politically aligned with you, or do you find yourself arguing with him?
Yeah, no, we're very politically aligned. I would say I'm probably more conservative than my father. My father's probably more of a liberal.
Interesting.
What I have discovered is that from activism and having a position on something to trying to get something done on an area, you cannot hold on to strict positions because you find that the perfect is enemy of the good, and that you can't move anything forward.
Compromise.
You have to. You have to find ways. So you try to hold on to your principles, try to hold on to your beliefs, but at the same time, I've been informed by the process of having to get things done. So I'm probably more conservative than my dad.
You're in a business that sells tickets to the public of all stripes. Is it risky to be political when you're in that business?
Yes. Yes, it is risky. It is not risky in terms of the Hollywood community, because generally speaking, the Hollywood community is liberal, more so than conservative. But when you take political positions, when you take views and you put yourself out there, and especially in this day and age, in this country, you're upsetting half the country. By nature of what you stand for, you're upsetting half the country. And that half the country may take it out on you in terms of going to a movie that you've made or something like that. They may be able to see past your politics and enjoy a film that may not have politics, but it's certain we've seen that happen to a lot of artists, you know, the Dixie Chicks or a lot of people. It does hurt. It does hurt.
Is that something that the studios sort of wish didn't occur, that they wish you guys would stay out of it, or not so much?
No, because the studios, they make all different types of pictures. Mostly they make tentpole type movies, you know, what they call franchise movies, movies that are, action pictures, the X-Men, Hunger Games, those kind of things. And those films don't have too much politics in it. There's a little bit. And then they also, there is room for Hurt Locker. I mean, there are, you don't get as broad an audience, right, but there is room for Hurt Locker and, Zero Dark Thirty and, Argo. And look at Argo. I mean, it's doing very well. And so there is room for those kinds of pictures.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the causes that you care about. Probably at the top of the list, Proposition 8, the ban on gay marriage.
Right now, yes.
Yeah. How did you get involved in that? And give us your thoughts on where that, it's before the Supreme Court or will be, where that issue is going and why you got involved.
Well, first of all, You know, as I said, civil rights was discussed at my table as a kid growing up. You know, people have always, of my generation, they say, well, you remember where you were when Kennedy was assassinated. We all do remember. I remember where I was when Medgar Evers was assassinated. And I made a movie about the re-prosecution of Medgar Evers. So he was the first, you know, major civil rights leader that got assassinated in 1963. So the idea of civil rights and the idea of all of us being equal was something that was always talked about in my household. So then, flash forward, I'm making a movie, The American President, and a young man named Chad Griffin, who was 19 years old at the time, was working for Dee Dee Myers, who was the head of communication for President Clinton at the time, and he was assigned to me to help me research the film. And I went to the White House, and Chad Griffin showed me around, and he, you know, took me all throughout the White House, and I became friends with him. He wound up running my foundation for early childhood education. And Chad, you know, oddly enough, and I make this joke, I knew Chad was gay before he knew it. I mean, he came from Arkansas, a very, you know, a conservative state, and he suppressed all of those feelings for a very long time. And at one point he came to me, and it was like, I feel like a father to him. He's like, he was 19, I was much older, and I'm very, very close to this guy. And now he's the head of the human rights campaign. He's, you know, he's a big deal now. But I'm so proud every time I see him on television. I thought, oh, there's my son, you know. But he, I asked him to run my organization. And after a while, he came to me and said, he said, Rob, I have to tell you something. He says, I'm gay. And I said, yeah, what else is new? You know, we knew. I mean, and as time goes by, and one of the reasons we took on Proposition 8, aside from the obvious reasons of marriage equality and we should all be treated equal under the law, and it's, you know, it was a bad initiative, and, you know, the courts have already overturned it. We hope the Supreme Court will uphold those rulings. But it was partly an education process. We discover as we go along that, first of all, there's not one person in this audience or anywhere that doesn't have a gay person in their family or a gay friend or a gay person that they work with in their workplace. Nobody. Nobody. So the normalizing of things, the being able to teach, the being able to show people that everybody is equal, that nobody is different. If they can do, if they're doing their job, it shouldn't be thought of as different. That was one of the reasons we took on Prop 8, and one of the reasons we did the Play 8, which was a dramatization of what went on inside the courtroom here in San Francisco at the district trial. We put that on because we wanted to show people what actually went on in that courtroom and to normalize it. And so we find that as we move along, the wind is at our back. It is like we're hitting critical mass. You're seeing more and more states adopting it. Now Great Britain, you're seeing more countries. It will happen. It is supposed to happen. And I've said this many, many times, that we can't imagine that there was a time that women couldn't vote. We can't imagine that there were times when black people couldn't vote. We can't imagine there was a time when black people couldn't marry white people. And there will be a time years from now where we'll say, gay marriage? What was that fuss all about? It's going to take time, and we are moving in the right direction, but it is about a fundamental right. And we cannot look at our fellow citizens, and I couldn't look at Chad Griffin, who is somebody who I love, and say, you are lesser than me. You deserve less than me. You are a second-class citizen. You can't do that. You can't feel comfortable about yourself knowing that there are millions of people in this country that are not considered equal under the law.
Do you think are you optimistic about what the Supreme Court will do?
I am optimistic. I mean, you never know when a case is in front of the Supreme Court. But if they are going to rule, and this is what they do, based on the law, we had a trial here in San Francisco with many weeks of evidence. We brought on 17 witnesses. They brought on two. And one of their witnesses, who was their expert against the idea of gay marriage, has done a 180. His name is David Blankenhorn, and has now said it absolutely should be something that should be done. And if you look at it just from a legal standpoint, there is really nothing to argue. You can argue from a moral standpoint. You can say morally, I don't like the idea of gay marriage because your church teaches you a certain thing. That's fine. And we're not asking anybody, we're not forcing any church to perform ceremonies. We're not asking anybody to go outside their religious beliefs. But marriage is not a religious right. It is a civil right that is provided by the government. A church does not have a right to marry someone except that it is given the right by the government. The government issues marriage licenses. The government decides who gets married and who doesn't. So in 1967, there was a Supreme Court case, Loving versus Virginia, and blacks couldn't marry whites. They challenged that, and the Supreme Court ruled that 9-0. It was, and they have ruled now 14 times about the fundamental right to marriage. So, and from a legal standpoint, there is no argument. You can make a moral standpoint if you want, but from a legal standpoint, there is no argument. So we feel confident that we now, how broadly the Supreme Court will rule, that we don't know. And that we'll have to see. I mean, the Ninth Circuit, which is the appellate court that that heard the case, they issued an opinion that can be taken a number of ways. Maybe the Supreme Court just upholds the Ninth Circuit's opinion that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional because it took away a right that was initially had by gays and lesbians. So they may just rule in terms of that. But we also argued that there is a fundamental right to marriage. So if they rule on that basis, then that marriage will be made a fundamental right for everybody in the country. That doesn't mean immediately every state you can go to and you can get married. Brown versus the Board of Education, 1954, said separate but not equal is not equal. And that every black person has a right to go to whatever school they want to, every public school they want to. But there were many prejudices against that in many of the southern states, and it took a long time before the schools could be integrated, you know. So it may take a while, even if we win the case in the broadest sense, for all that to happen. But it will happen. It will happen. I mean, this is not, it's just a matter of time, you know. And hopefully, you know, the Supreme Court will be on the right side of history, and I think they will.
When you produce a play like 8 on a social issue, and you've done that a number of times over your career, is that a different demand? It must be satisfying to tell a story about which you are so passionate politically, but that's a different set of demands and research that has to go into it. There's sort of a historical accuracy that has to be a part of it, I would think.
Well,
or you're not making a documentary necessarily.
No, but Lance Black, the writer of the play 8, who also won an Academy Award for Milk, you know, the story of Harvey Milk, he basically took the transcripts and made it a trial, you know, basically dramatized the transcripts. Anything that is said by a witness in the play was taken exactly word for word from the transcripts of the trial. Now, he added some personal stuff about the plaintiffs, and that was brought in to dramatize. But if you wanted to know what went on inside that courtroom, because they didn't allow cameras in the courtroom, you just look at that play, and it'll tell you exactly what happened during that trial.
This the fight that you've been leading against Prop 8, I imagine that it has it come at any personal cost at all in terms
not
of friendships?
Not to me. And you know something? I don't care. I mean, you know, if somebody wants to not like me because I want everybody to have equality, then they should go someplace
right.
else. That's not what America's about.
Right.
That is not what America's about.
One of the other issues that you care about, and I'm curious, and one of the members of the audience wants to ask why you got into the anti-smoking campaign. Is there some personal reason?
Well, the anti-smoking campaign was in conjunction with early childhood development. We tried to find a way to use some funds to, which, you know, smoking is bad for children, bad for their health, bad for, you know, in prenatal care and all of that. And we also wanted to expand it to include all aspects of school readiness, health care, child care, preschool, parent education, all the things that would be helpful for a child to get off on the right track. So it was connected, it was not just about anti-smoking, it was also about early childhood development.
Thank you. One of the other issues, and I want to just touch a few and then we'll go back and talk in detail.
Some
environmental causes that you care about, climate change. Are you working on a project involving climate change?
Well, climate change is the big ticket item. Right. You know, I've said many times, I mean, we've got basically two issues, two things that we think about, and when you think about in a global way, and I think very big. It doesn't necessarily get me into too good a straight, but I do think big. There's the planet, and then there's the people living on the planet, and basically that's it. So what can we do? No, what can we do to make life better for the people living on the planet? So, you know, my take was, if we gave every young child, a good start in life, made sure that they had good nurturing parental experiences early on in life, if they had the right kind of health care, if they had the right early education, they would have an opportunity to live a happy, productive, you know, fruitful life. Then there's the planet that we live on, you know, so the idea was, with early childhood, if we give people what they need, we will produce non-toxic adults. They will not harm society. They will not act out against their neighbor. They won't rape. They won't steal. They won't, kill. And then do we have a planet, a toxic or non-toxic planet? And so that is the other issue. And I've always said, if you don't have a healthy planet, nothing else means anything. You know, it doesn't matter whether, I hope my Social Security check, none of it matters. You know, Social Security, gun control, whatever it is, none of it matters if you don't have a sustainable planet. So right now, climate change, you know, I mean, there's I think 7 people in this country that don't believe in the science. They talk a lot too for some reason. I don't know how they see. That's another thing about the media. You know, they always talk about balance. You know, some things are just not balanced. There is one side and then there's not another side. You know, and I think on climate change, there is really only one side here. And so, you know, the science is in on this. The jury of the scientists are in on this. And that is, we have a problem with climate change. So that's the other big ticket item. And, you know, how to do something about that, it's very complicated. It's a very tough problem because you have entrenched interests that are screaming and yelling and with a lot of money. And if you have a lot of money, you can get the 7 people to say what they want to say. And the media will give them as much time as the 97% whatever of the others. So that's something we will work on, and we're thinking about how to approach that. And that's going to be a big comprehensive effort if we pull it off.
It's also a global problem because you have emerging markets and countries
right.
that are industrializing,
right.
developing.
Right, right. But I believe there is an enormous economy, a green economy, that is the next big boom. And that those technologies can be exported. Those technologies can help bring along some of these emerging countries, these third world countries. We have to, and the other thing is, we have no option. It's not like there's an option. You know, there's a fear right now amongst people who are in the know that we've already maybe waited too long, because there's a point at which things are irreversible. We may be already at that place. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. It's like this gun control debate they have. Does it mean because there's not one thing you can do that's going to eradicate all gun violence that you shouldn't do anything? You have to try. You have to try and do something.
On the subject, Rob, of gun control, this is from someone in the audience. You mentioned that Hollywood tends to be more on the liberal side. There is a lot of violence in film, certainly a lot of gunplay in film. And I would imagine the Hollywood community, many of them, favor gun control, and yet gun violence is sort of celebrated in the movies. Is that an inherent conflict, and does that help that issue?
It doesn't help the issue, I can tell you that. I don't believe there's a conflict in terms of what needs to be done. And I'm not a guy who makes those kinds of movies, so I'm not like protecting my franchise or anything, but I've read every study now done about the effects of violent movies and violent video games on young people in terms of their proclivity to act out, and there isn't a correlation. Now, that doesn't mean to say that young people who have mental illnesses and have problems who also watch those video games might be tipped over by something like that. Yes, but those people, if they didn't have access to guns, they'd probably go and stab somebody or hit somebody with a baseball bat or whatever.
Because of other issues.
Because of other issues. It's not like somebody, you know, this is the argument. They have the same video games, the same violent movies in Japan, in Canada, in England, all the same things, and nobody's getting killed there because they don't have the guns. I mean, so those kinds of things are not, I mean, if we saw outbreaks of violence based on these violent movies that we and it's our second biggest export is these movies to around the world. If we saw big outbreaks of violence because of that, then you say, hey, we got a case here.
So you believe that is a specious argument as far as you're concerned?
I think it is. I don't see the connection. I haven't been able to see the connection. You can feel like there's a connection, but feeling like there's a connection and actually a connection that you can actually see. I mean, you can see a person with a gun shooting somebody. So you know that person having the gun, killing the other person, that's causing the guy to die. We know that's happening.
You talk, Rob, with, it seems, equal passion about these social issues as you do making movies. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I would say I probably talk more passionately about them because movies are fun and people get entertained, and I get a tremendous pleasure when people come up to me and say, you've entertained me over the years. That makes me feel good. I feel good that I made people feel good, you know? But then there's this other thing which is more lasting and hopefully, you know, contributes to making a much healthier world. So I do get more passionate about those things, yeah. But I like to make people laugh, too. I mean, that has helped. It helps.
We need that.
You do need it.
It's balanced.
You got to be laughing while you're fighting some of those seven people, you know. Because it's hard, boy.
You considered a run a few years ago for governor.
Yes, I did. I did consider.
Would you ever consider that again? Or why did you decide not to run?
Okay, first I'll tell you why I decided not to. As you know, it takes a tremendous toll on the family, you know, putting yourself in, you know, out there in a public arena like that. And, you know, I do anyway. And I had a meeting with my family, and because I was seriously considering it. And my kids were young at the time. My youngest son was friends with Patrick Schwarzenegger, so he knew, you know, that the Secret Service detail, you know, that would follow, you know, the security detail that would follow him around. He didn't like that idea. And we sat around, and there was my three kids, me and my wife, and my son was crying, Daddy, please don't do it. I don't want you to do it. My little daughter says, Daddy, I don't want you. My wife didn't want it. My oldest son was in support of me. And basically, I polled 40% in my family. I didn't carry my family, so I figured if I can't carry my family, I better not do this. You know?
Do you regret
that's
that?
That's about as good a constituency as I can get.
Do you regret that decision at all?
No, I don't regret it at all. Because what I've discovered also, particularly in California, and I think Jerry Brown's done an incredible job considering what he had to deal with here. You know, this state was left in an absolute mess by the previous administration. And to be able to get it on track with the governance structure that we have here in California, which forces you to get a two-thirds majority to pass a budget, a two-thirds majority to raise taxes, and that's why he decided to put an initiative on the ballot rather than go through the legislature, which, by the way, even though I've benefited from the initiative process in passing Proposition 10 for early childhood, I'm not in favor of the initiative process personally. I don't think it's a good way to govern because most people don't really know what's in these initiatives. They don't know the implications of it. They don't know really what they're voting for. They're voting based on 30-second ads and who has the most money to take out ads. But you then have to allow your elected representatives the ability to govern. And if you're hamstringing them with a two-thirds majority every time for anything significant, it makes it difficult. So I think basically being governor of California is very difficult because of the governance structure. Now, that's not to say there aren't great elected positions where you can actually get stuff done. If you look at the mayor of New York, for instance, there's a great city charter in New York which allows you tremendous latitude to get things done, and I think Bloomberg's done a very good job. But, you know, in Los Angeles, the charter is much weaker. So the mayor of Los Angeles doesn't have control over the education system throughout the city of Los Angeles. So, you know, it depends on the job. And what I've discovered is I can use my whatever I have, whatever, you know, avenues I have, better. I'm better serving in looking at openings and taking them. It's like, you know, I see an opening. It's like a guy with a football. You know, I say, oh, there's some daylight. I'm going to go there. That's what we did on the decision to go on the federal court case on Prop 8. We saw that there was a possibility to get this done, an actual possibility, because I'm not unmindful of the politics of it. I'm not unmindful of the economics of it and how to, and plus of the religious implications and all of that. But I could see the Supreme Court, I could see the way the country was moving, and I just felt, along with Chad and my wife and Christina and Lance Black and Bruce, and we saw an opening there, and we took it. So
you feel that's how you can be most
well. Look what look what can happen if the Supreme Court rules. It's on March 26th. If they rule in the way we hope they will, think about the impact of that. This is the last piece of the civil rights puzzle. This is the last leg. This is the last group of people that is still considered a second-class citizen, unequal under the law. We finish that. That's a big thing to do. So you look for your opening and you take it, you know, and that's the way to do it.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Hollywood legend and political activist Rob Reiner about films, politics, and the future of marriage equality. Rob,
you know, you use that term legend, and it makes me
seem old.
It makes me seem old, but it also puts pressure on me that I have to be more intelligent than I really am.
On the subject of intelligence, you are obviously extremely intelligent and very well informed on these issues, and you use your celebrity for great purpose.
I try to.
Sometimes you talk about the electorate not necessarily always being as informed as we might be. How do you feel about celebrities who lend their names to causes who may not be so well informed?
Well, I don't think that's a good idea.
It happens a lot, though.
That's a good idea.
It happens a lot.
It does happen because you have this confluence between Washington and Hollywood. You know, they've often said that Washington is Hollywood for ugly people. You know,
it's a great line.
I didn't say it. Somebody said it.
It's a great
somebody
old line.
Somebody said it. But the truth of the matter is, you know, Washington can uses Hollywood a lot of times because a celebrity can bring attention to a particular issue. And if it's an issue that they're trying to push, they can use a celebrity. Celebrities like to use Washington because it gives them some more what they think gravitas, or they gives them some more seriousness or, you know, substantive thoughts about things. But what I've discovered is that if you steep yourself in an issue, if you really do understand the issue, the ins and outs, and can get down in the weeds and out wonk a wonk on a particular issue, you can actually really move the ball forward. You can not only draw attention to something, but you can actually move the ball forward. I look at somebody like Michael J. Fox, who's really understands the science of Parkinson's and how to move, and stem cell research, and how to move all that stuff forward. Then celebrity can be used good. But if a celebrity just wants to be seen and wants to dance around, then he makes a fool of himself and also ultimately hurts whatever particular issue he's trying to push. So it's a double-edged sword, and I always counsel celebrities, if you're going to get into something, really do your homework and really understand what it is you're trying
to
do.
Be serious about it.
Yeah, and really understand it, so that when the reporters and when news people ask you and they start drilling down, be able to answer the second, third, fourth, fifth tier questions, right, and be able to go, you know, be the smartest guy in the room.
Right.
Be as smart as anybody who's an expert on it. Become an expert.
You campaigned for President Obama, reelected, of course, just inaugurated. Your assessment on some liberals were disappointed in his first 4 years. Many were pleased at some of the things he did. What do you hope he accomplishes in the next 4 years that he did not accomplish in the past?
Well, he did a lot. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of liberals were unhappy because he maybe didn't exhibit the kind of fire and passion that he did on the stump. But if you look at, you know, he's a cool customer, and if you look at what he did, I mean, he did save an auto industry, he did kill bin Laden, he did pass universal health care coverage for the first time since it was brought up in 1948. There were some major, major accomplishments done in a very kind of quiet way. There are obviously huge big ticket items still out there. We still have to get our fiscal house in order. That's going to take some doing. He's certainly not going to be able to do it during his term, but he can put it on a path towards some kind of sustainability down the road. Secondly, they're fighting on immigration reform right now. I believe that may get to be done, because you've got, you know, political interests on the right, maybe not such heartfelt interests, but at least political interests on the right, to get that done. What we can do on gun safety, I'm not sure. It seems like universal background checks should pass every, I mean, even the NRA members are, you know, 80-some-odd percent in favor of that. That could be a done. But the big-ticket items are going to come down to climate change. Climate change is the big one. I hope something starts emerging on that. He did mention it in the State of the Union, and then the fiscal stuff. So hopefully we can see some stuff happening on climate change.
Okay. There's a movie coming out with Matt Damon. This is from the audience, called Promised Land.
It's out, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's out. I saw it. It's about fracking.
That's right.
Yeah.
Are movies, this is again from a member of the audience, are movies that call attention to issues, even though they're dramatizations, are those, do you think those serve to educate? Are they helpful
Absolutely.
On these issues? Or are
Absolutely.
They just entertainment and they
no,
come and go?
Well, they're mostly they should be just entertainment, but they do help. I mean, there have been many, they're certainly not going to change something overnight, but they become part of the dialogue. People go to movies. People watch television. It becomes part of the discussion. There were major prison reforms made after the movie I Was a Prisoner from a Chain Gang, when that came out. Actual prison reforms happened because of that movie. So the movie in and of itself is not going to miraculously change anything, but it certainly adds to the dialogue. And I think, you know, I, for one, saw the movie, and I want to know more about fracking. Hmm. I want to know what's the truth about fracking. You know, what actually is, EPA is starting to study that now. You know, I don't think anybody knows the real truth about it. We know the disasters that happen, but that happens with everything. Right. You know, so is there a way to do it that's environmentally sound? And then we should. And then is there a way to safeguard it? Then yes. If not, then it's not good. But I'm curious about it now, and largely because of that movie.
So it's a chance to inform ourselves.
Yes, absolutely.
As a starting point.
Open up the dialogue.
We touched a little bit on early childhood development, but I want to ask you a little bit more, because I know that's something you're also very passionate about. Your concerns about the state of education in California and the country. You know, so many statistics show that we are so far behind many other nations.
Well, California, you talk about California because California educates one out of every eight children in America. And California, before Proposition 13, had the best education system in the country. We now have, if not the worst, close to the worst in the country. So if we are able to fix the education system in California, that will go a long way towards making a healthy education system in America. It's a very complicated thing because Prop 13 is the third rail of California politics, and money alone is not going to solve the problem. We have to see reform and money come together. But you can't have just reform. You need reform and resources. They both have to come together at the same time. But there are ways to do it. There are certain models for what constitutes a good education system. I would submit that you have a quality early childhood preschool education for every child. So by the time they're, you know, that to me is my big fight, because, you know, by third grade, when you're 8 years old, you should be reading, because you learn to read so that you can read to learn. And if you're not reading by the third grade, you're off the rails. And the reason you see the 50% and more dropout rate at college is because the kids are not keeping up. But kids that have had access to high quality preschool are kids that are not dropping out of school. So you have to start at the beginning with integrating a comprehensive early childhood education program from the get-go. And then we're talking about reforming the K-12 system, which needs reform and teacher training and being able to make sure that a qualified teacher's in every class, and then resources. And both of those things need to come together. There are a lot of moneyed people around this state who are nervous about putting money into our system, or because they know it's going to be money thrown down a rat hole and a bad. So we have to go with reform at the same time, and we need to see real reform. And if we don't, there's no chance to even talk about reforming Prop 13, not getting rid of Prop 13, but reforming Prop 13.
All right. Let's spend the last few minutes, Rob, if it's all right with you, lightening it up a little bit and talking about a few more.
You mean Prop 13 isn't funny? I thought Prop 13 was a riot. Hey, let's kick the old lady out of the house.
He makes it funny.
Try to make it funny.
A couple questions from the audience that I know people want to get to. Let me start with this one. This is an interesting, I don't know where you'll take this, but is humor inherently liberal? That's an interesting note.
No, I don't think it's inherently liberal, but you find more liberal people funnier. Because look at South Park. Those guys, Parker and Stone, they're equal opportunity satirists.
Right.
They skew the right and the left, you know. So, no, it doesn't have to be liberal, but I find, generally speaking, liberals are funnier because liberal means open, you know, open mind. Conservative means you conserve. You keep things as they are. Liberal means you open up yourself to all the different possibilities. When you do that, there's more of an opportunity to find what's dopey about the world, you know.
Someone in the audience, and as we talked about this backstage here, one of my favorite movies over the years has been one of yours, Princess Bride, which was such a charming movie. And
you are
very proud of that movie because it endures.
It has. This year we had the 25th anniversary of Princess Bride. We had a celebration at the Lincoln Center, and everybody came back together. And what a thrill to know that a movie you've made, people are, you know, they quote As You Wish, and My Name Is Inigo Montoya. A guy was on the plane the other day. He had an Inigo Montoya T-shirt. People said, I don't want that guy on the plane. They made him cover it up because it said, you killed my father, prepare to die. they got nervous.
Not wise on a plane.
But I love that, and I love that people come up to me and they say, you know, my wedding ring, it says As You Wish inside of it, or, you know, kids who saw the movie when they were 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, now grown up, and they have little kids, and they're introducing the kids to the movie. It makes me feel great. I have one great story about it was these years ago. Nora Ephron, who just passed away, was a good friend. She wrote When Harry Met Sally. We went to a restaurant. She said, you know, there's a restaurant, very good Italian place. John Gotti goes there every Thursday night. I said, oh, okay, we'll go. We'll see. It's probably going to be a safe. Maybe it's not such a safe. But I went, we'll go there. So we go there, and 8 o'clock, sure enough, John Gotti walks into the restaurant with like 6 wise guys. They sit down at a table, and I look over there, and I see him. He kind of sees me. We kind of recognize him. I don't want to say like I recognize him too much, you know. Like, you know, you stay over there, but over there. But we finish our meal, then I go outside, and there's a big limo parked out of there, and a guy in front of the limo who looks like Luca Brasi from The Godfather, and he looks at me, he goes, "You killed my father, prepare to die." I said, "Oh my God. Oh my, I got so scared." He says, "I love that movie, The Princess Bride."
It's a little unnerving coming from
It was
from
a little unnerving. I got nervous.
Again, from the audience, this is an interesting question. This is one of the great moments on television and the golden age of television. Was the Sammy Davis Jr. kiss of Archie Bunker spontaneous, or did they plan that?
No, we planned it.
We planned it,
and it was the longest laugh we had. We had two long laughs that were about the same length. The Sammy Davis Jr. kiss, the audience just never stopped. There was another one where this was like the seventh episode we ever did. My character was very anxious about having to take final exams, and my character became impotent. Just, you know, showbiz, you know. And the whole thing was Gloria was all upset that we couldn't make love, blah, blah, blah. And so Archie goes down to the bar and he runs into Jefferson and he says to Jefferson, "You people are good with these things and these issues."
That's, I know this
he
one.
Says, my son, he's, how should I say, he's stuck in neutral. And that got one of the biggest laughs we ever had.
Yeah. What is it like, all in the family? What is it like to have been part of a TV family that is so iconic? And
was,
you stayed in touch with many of them over the years?
It was great. It was really great. I mean, it was like your family. I mean, we spent more time with a television family than we did with our real family. And it was a great experience. I learned, it was my master's degree. You know, I've always said, when I was a kid, a little kid, I went to see my dad work on the Dick Van Dyke Show, and I was 13, 14, 15, 16, and in the summer times I'd spend all day, every day, watching him work with the actors, write the scripts, and help the stage, and that was like me going to college and learning about how to do it. And All in the Family, to me, was like the masters. I got to see how, you know, shows are put together, how to tell stories in front of the audience, what audiences like, what they don't like. It was a great experience for me. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Last question, Rob. You've made so many fantastic movies. You've been so involved politically and had such an effective life in so many respects. Is there a project that you've always wanted? You often hear about actors or directors talk about a movie that took them 10 years to make. Do you have one of those that in the back of your mind there's something you really want to do and you haven't gotten to yet?
I've had projects that I've wanted to make that I have been able to make for one reason or another, but not one that I'm that's the one. But there have been a couple. I've always wanted to make the great baseball movie. I mean, I'm a huge baseball fan. As a kid growing up, I was a New York Giant fan and then a San Francisco Giant fan because I loved Willie Mays and, you know, I admired him so much. And so I love baseball. So I've always wanted to do something about that. I've tried to do that. I've always wanted to do a musical. You know, just a movie musical, not like Spinal Tap, but I mean, a real musical with a story, with characters and things. And I've tried that, and I have been able to do that. So, and then I've also wanted to do a movie about what happened during the '60s, what actually happened during the '60s, and because I think it certainly informed my generation and all the issues that were going on. You know, the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, sexual revolution, the drug culture, and all that. And so those are the three areas that I've been interested in.
He's going to be busy.
Well, I don't know. We'll see what we could do.
Last thing, do you have an Oscar pick for Best Picture?
Well, you know, I would have said Lincoln, you know, up until seeing Argo win all these awards. I think it's between those two. I still think Lincoln has a shot. I loved Daniel Day-Lewis. I thought he did a magnificent job. I think he will win. I think he will win, and I'm kind of partial to Jennifer Lawrence in Silver Linings Playbook, which I like very much, too. So.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Rob Reiner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Rob Reiner, renowned actor, director, screenwriter, producer, political activist, for sharing his many thoughts with us today on both politics and the entertainment industry. I think we can all agree, just an absolutely fantastic discussion. We want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Dan Ashley, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are
here
in the know,
the
is adjourned. I always feel like a judge when I do this.
Ah.